you were saying.
I think the, Sean didn't come prominently into the picture because he was afraid to get too closely involved. I think he was too uncertain of his position, and of the support that he really had, to involve himself too closely. I don't know whether it's often, how often this observation has been made, but he was, in those days, he was very unsure of himself. I think he wanted to be like his father, but he didn't have the drive, perhaps. I think perhaps he'd also been spoiled by his education in Switzerland. I don't know how good a student he was, but he inevitably would have picked up some feelings and some ideas about the proper of the European idea of relationship between the governor and the governed, certainly. And although I couldn't document it, I've sometimes suspected that his Swiss education made him unfit to be the kind of ruler that Iran had always had. But it was the, the fact that that Ajax succeeded gave him a considerable amount of courage. He always insisted afterwards that that was a demonstration of the loyalty of the people to him. Maybe it was, in a sense, but you know, there were other factors. And I think Dick Cottam, in his Nationalism in Iran, has made the point, made the statement that, and of course Cottam was very close to the Nationalists when he was in the embassy there. He made the point that an operation like Ajax could not have succeeded if there had not been a great deal of popular support for what was being attempted. Maybe I can give you a couple of anecdotes that sort of illustrate that. When I was highly stationed in Iran, I knew Admiral Rasadi. I don't know if you know the name or not.
Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Commander of the Navy.
The Navy?
He's here in Washington.
He's in Washington?
Yeah. You were saying that he was head of Rasadi was head of Department 7 of SOROC. That's where you met him.
Yeah. So
go ahead, yes.
He told me one time, we got talking about what had happened in 1953. And he said, well, he was surprised at the stories later about the American participation. He said, I was out there in the crowds, in the pro-shop crowds, hiding under a truck and shooting my pistol when I had to. And he said, I didn't even know any Americans. And then, just an anecdote, but another sort of similar thing. We had kind of a crook on a general handyman, Hussein Sabzalizadeh.
What was his last name?
Sabzalizadeh. He was an Azerbaijani.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking, once the same thing came up, and he said almost the same thing. He said, I was for the Shah, and I was in the crowds shouting for the Shah. And he said, I didn't know any Americans. He said, it didn't make any difference to me. Mm-hmm. I was for the Shah. Hussein, incidentally, had once been worked as a cook in the Royal Palace under Reza Shah, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, a couple of anecdotes.
Right.
I think it serves to illustrate Cottam's point. that there was a great reservoir of pro-Shah, or at least pro-monarchy feelings at the time, which Operation Ajax merely channeled and was able to direct.
Had the Shah not been part of it, would the Iranian military have been able to pull off the coup on its own?
You say, could the Iranian military have done it?
On its own, without the Shah? Or let's put it this way. The question always comes into mind when one looks back as to General Zahedi played an important role in galvanizing the military for a coup. And it's not characteristic that somebody would do that and then step aside for someone else. And I was wondering, when you were mentioning earlier that the British had a distrust of him, that were the British instrumental in bringing the Shah into the picture just not to have Zahedi running the whole show?
I don't know that that's the case. I suppose it's a possibility, but then, you know, the Shah had sufficient confidence after he came back. It may have been misplaced, but he had enough confidence that he was willing to take a stronger stand on many things. And I think one of the things that perhaps he decided in his own mind is that he could no longer tolerate somebody who, like Mossadegh, who was a threat to his position as Shah. Zahedi, I think probably the Shah at some point thought Zahedi was getting too much popularity and took measures to move him out. Zahedi, I believe, was something of a disappointment in that he didn't get things on he didn't get the Iranian political and economic system back on an even keel and making some progress, mm-hmm. as well as perhaps everybody thought that he should have been able to. Mm-hmm. So I don't recall that there was a whole lot of pressure on the Shah to keep Zahedi after the Shah had made it clear that he wanted Zahedi to go. I once made the criticism that I thought that the major problem with Ajax, with the operation, was that after having successfully moved Mossadegh out, that then the United States and Britain both drew back so far and let the Iranian politicians take over, that things tended to move back into the pre-Mossadegh form. Whereas if we had been willing or able to take a more active role in advising Zahedi or pressuring Zahedi, or perhaps being more aggressive to try to get him to do things that we thought should be done, would have been more successful. But we actually, having done that, then we kind of sat back and said, okay, straighten things out again now. And of course it took a long time to do that.
What did the success of this operation do to the thinking within CIA on Iran or the Middle East? The general attitude towards Iran and the Middle East in CIA, did it change the way CIA operated? I mean, some have suggested it might have given complacency or...
Well, I don't think it changed the way it operated. It was seen as something of a blueprint, because it was really the first
successful
first such thing had been tried, and it was a very small operation. actually, there were just probably not more than a handful of Americans involved. Not much money, very little money, compared to the very big figures that you see. I think it was studied as maybe a model of the way things should be done. If you had to do something like this, this was sort of a blueprint. But I think the blueprint was forgotten later because it depended on one key thing, and that is the operation channeled a support for the monarchy that was already there, that was forming us in the right direction. But I think there's also something else, perhaps. Maybe there was support for monarchy as an institution, I expect, as opposed to Muhammad, Reza Shah specifically. But I think there was probably also considerable public disturbance, public unease over the what had been going on for the previous 3 years, rioting, demonstrations. After a while, people get tired of things like that.
And what extent did Tudeh play a role? The fear of the Tudeh party, to what extent did that play a role?
Well, I think it played played a role in bringing the clergy in on the Shah's side, which seems kind of a strange thing to say now, but the clergy generally supported the Shah because of a distrust of communism. On the other hand, I don't think the clergy knew a whole lot about communism or about the Tudor party. I think what they knew was the fact that the communists in the USSR had rejected religion of any kind. And even Khashoggi came in ultimately on the Shah's side. Of course, he'd had a dispute with Mossadegh before that. As I understand, what money did go out to the crowds went from Aramish to Khashoggi and then out to the crowds.
From Aramish?
Yeah.
Well, who was that?
Oh, gosh.
He was the...
He was...
National Francis, or
he was associated. He was an opportunist. For one thing, he was a political opportunist. He was quite prominent in those days. And I'm trying to remember his first name. He was quite prominent in those days in political infighting, in political influencing. This sort of a thing. You have to...
I'll find out when you...
Ahmed Aramish.
Ahmed Aramish.
As I recall, he was... I believe he was killed in a shootout with the police some 15 or 20 years afterwards. I'm very vague on this. And he got caught in a plot against the Shah, was killed in a shootout when police raided a meeting he was having, something of the sort.
At this period when he was paying Koshani, who was he working with?
Mm-hmm.
Ramesh.
God knows, I suppose for probably for the interest of the British.
Oh, I see.
He acted as a conduit for money.
So Koshani was receiving money from Operation Ajax.
My understanding is that he was, although he may not have known.
Wait, it's kind of
or he may have suspected, you know, somebody like Aramis comes up with a few thousand dollars to give to Koshani. Koshani was shrewd enough to know probably that Aramis didn't pull him out of his own pocket and he was getting it from someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
But
did you travel to Iran yourself during this period? Did you go to Iran during this period?
No, the first time I went to Iran was 1954, right afterwards.
Right afterwards.
Right after the demonstrations against the Baha'i and when the Baha'i Temple was destroyed. I went there the next summer.
You went there for... do you recollect anything about that incident? Anything particular? Why and how was your assessment of it, the anti-Baha'i?
Well, it was, of course, Falsafi. Falsafi,
yes.
Speech on the radio that apparently set it off. There had been a few anti-Baha'i incidents earlier. We usually took note of them, but it wasn't the kind of thing that we spent much time on. Let's see if I can recollect. I think the feeling of the embassy at the time was philosophy. Let's see, was this a Muharram speech or something of the sort? I've kind of forgotten.
Well, that we can
talk about this. I think the story was that philosophy had said something to the Shah about, you know, he wanted to make a speech against the apostates and unbelievers and so on. And the Shah probably said, well, yeah, that's okay. You know, this is what a clergyman is supposed to do. Not realizing that what Falsafi had in mind was an attack on the Baha'i.
Mm-hmm.
And the story or the feeling got around that the Shah had approved the attack on the Baha'i. And you know, Bakhtiar was out prominent in the in tearing down the dome over the temple there, and just all,
yes,
yeah. I think the Shah was kind of appalled at what had happened when he found out that there was this misunderstanding. It was interesting for a couple of reasons. Not that it didn't ruin large in political thinking, obviously, but it did show that it was possible to whip up a mob against the Baha'i even after a considerable number of years of tolerance. And secondly, that even the most prominent officials, if they thought the Shah approved it, were willing to join in, like Bakhtiar.
Did they make the CIA aware of the potential of the political power of the clergy?
Yeah, the activities of Koshani, of course, was a political mullah. In those days, it did lead to a couple of studies on the clergy. On the structure, on personalities, but once that was over and Mashani dropped from view, everybody pretty much forgot about that. I think from the American point of view, we were victims of our own philosophy. The idea that in the modern world, the clergy could not only want to, but be capable of wielding such political power, and it came as a shock because, as you well know, the major, one of the major arguments in American politics, one of the major impulses, is to keep government and religion separated. And every day in the paper, they read some damn thing about somebody suing somebody for praying in school, or sitting out under a tree reading the Bible, or, you know, all kinds of things like that. But we have so ingrained in our own philosophy of politics the idea that there is this wall of separation, which the Supreme Court called it, between religion and politics, that intellectually we could not see the clergy any place playing that kind of a political role. Obviously, it was a mistake.
But something like the anti-Baha'i Falsafi's role in the anti-Baha'i agitations, how were these interpreted then at the CIA, for instance?
Well, of course, everyone who was had some interest or done some work on Iran knew the history of the Baha'i, or at least something about the fact that they were, by the clergy, they were considered apostates, and that apostasy was a death sentence. So it did not seem, I don't think it struck anybody as unusual that a prominent clergyman should attack the Baha'i. What was unusual about it, or that a prominent clergyman would want to attack the Baha'i, but what was unusual about it was the fact that in the face of a couple of decades of tolerance, of acceptance of the Baha'i, that a clergyman would do this openly and with the support of the Shah. As it turned out, as I just said, I think there was a misunderstanding on the Shah's part as to what philosophy intended. But then for years afterwards, although there may have been isolated incidents, there was no overt anti-Baha'i demonstrations. So I don't think this showed so much the power of the clergy to exert a political influence as it did the power of the clergy to whip up popular emotion on a very specific subject.
So you saw this as a limited nuisance factor?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was not something that had any political impact at the time, nor was it assessed as having any political implication. Indeed, although it's been years since I read the speech, I don't think it was specifically political. Of course, again, as I said, from Khashoggi's activities as a political ruler, it was obvious that some of the clergy could exert a political influence, but mostly it was on the the Southern Monarchy, the Bantahanes, and who else?
Budujerdi, yeah.
They were generally supportive of the monarchy. I say generally because certain on specific things they had had disagreements. When they got into the things like land reform, we had disagreements, and particularly the attitude that the Shah took toward toward women. There were disagreements with the clergy, and I suspect that even on the normally pro monarchy, if not pro Mohammed Reza, clergy, these were things that were so basic to them that, that they had to come out against them. I think even the Imam Juma,
Hassan Imami,
I think he came out from his position with the royal court and so on. He came out in opposition to land reform as being basically against the tenets of religion.
Now, during this period, after the Operation Ajax, it became more fully concentrated on Iran.
Yeah.
What happened? You went back to school, or did you learn Persian? And how was this done at CIA to educate a country specialist, in other words?
That was left, in those days, that was left pretty much up to the individual. I already had a PhD, mm-hmm. which was considered as at least an indication that a person had the interest and the ability to learn what he needed to know on his own, mm-hmm. without any formal education. I did over the next few years drop in on some courses at American, Georgetown, simply to round out some of my what I thought I knew and systematize some of it. I had studied one semester with Mehdi Hayri, mm-hmm. I think it was.
Mehdi Hayri, who
I think was himself an Ayatollah, oh, yes. That a very quite a different kind.
He comes here occasionally.
He does.
Well, he has Parkinson's disease, so he comes to Washington.
Oh, is that right?
For treatment once in a while.
Oh, I enjoy it very much. Mm-hmm. Because although he was perhaps not typical of the kind of clergy that took over, he nevertheless, because of his intellectual powers and obvious ability to look beyond the narrowest tenets of Islam to little broader fields of philosophy and religion, mm-hmm. he made a very impressive mm-hmm. presentation. Mm-hmm. Where does he usually live now? I thought I saw something suggesting he was in Meshed, or at least maybe his brother. It always interested me a great deal, mm-hmm. particularly,
So you were a student of Hayri. You said you were catching up on courses at Georgetown and here and there. And
yeah, well, I did that just to keep in touch academically a little bit from time to time. And because I wanted, as I say, I wanted to round out and maybe systematize some of the things that that I knew or thought I knew. Except for what I did with Hayri, I didn't do anything specific, any academic stuff specifically on Iran. Mm-hmm. Although I talked to a lot of academics,
This was part of, again, up to you, or this was routine at CIA? Analysts would be in touch with relative academicians in their own field?
Yeah, they were free to do it if the academician would talk to them. And, I had known Dick Cottom for a long time. And
he had been at the agency himself, no?
Yes, he had been.
Earlier.
But he had been very close to national frontists and nationalists, and a great deal of sympathy toward them. I had sympathy toward the nationalists too, mostly because they missed so many chances. They missed so many chances to, if you like.
Was it possible to stay in CIA for someone like Cotton, especially after Operation Agent?
Was it possible?
Was it possible for someone like Cotton, with such strong pro-nationalist and anti-Shah sentiments, to stay in the CIA after 1953?
He could have, but he chose not to.
But it was conducive to that view of Iran.
Oh yeah, on almost all problems. Across the board, you could find people arguing on every side of the problem, not only Iran but every place else. There was no party line. The only limitation that there was sometimes was there were so few people interested and knowledgeable, for example, about Iran. So few people working on the country. That the views you could exchange profitably were limited by the limited number of people you had available to talk to.
We got to the 1950s at this point, and we spoke a little bit about your education on Iran. After these events, you said you went to Iran after the Baha'i riots in the 50s.
Yeah, that was the first time that I went to Iran. That was just I stayed, I think, about a month. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I had been there.
This was just to acquaint you with the country?
Yeah, I also went to Turkey and Greece on the same trip. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was gone for 3 months. I spent about a month in each of the three countries. This is kind of an orientation trip.
Mm-hmm. And in the 50s, as we progress between, say, 54 and 60, which is another watershed period, how did CIA and yourself analyze Iranian politics?
I think during that period, Iranian politics was analyzed pretty much in terms of the positions of the Shah and his programs. Of course, it wasn't until after 62 that the White Revolution got really underway. But the Shah was already making noises to indicate that he was getting increasing power and influence. So this was one of the important factors in doing our analysis, is what the Shah's position was on a variety of things, how he interacted with not only with the military, which finally was pretty simple because he dominated the military, but also his relationship with the other politicians that showed up from time to time. Iqbal, for example. And then he was interesting because the Shah, I think, appointed Amini reluctantly.
But before we get to Amini, let me ask you this. A lot of questions about this have been raised, but after the fall of National Front in 1953-54, that the US maintained some kind of contact with it. That, say, for instance, someone like Dr. Shaigan came to America, he taught here, and that all of these, at least in Iran, were seen as way of putting these people in a pickle or trying to prevent them from going to the left, radicalizing by sort of giving him some kind of attention. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think contact was maintained to the extent that it was maintained primarily to find out what they were doing, what they were thinking. There was considerable not support, but considerable sympathy with the nationalists and the National Frontists, because they, most of them, had an out of Iran education, Europe and the United States. Politically, they spoke in terms of democracy that, you know, that we understood. Intellectually, I think they were probably closer to most of the Americans that they talked to than they were to the Shah, or they were to the bulk, to the mass of Iranians. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that there was consciously any attempt to keep them in kind of a fallback position. If the Shah fellas, we got these guys to prevent, or on the other hand, keep track of them so we could tell the Shah what they were doing. That was never the case either. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you envision a role for them in Iran? So did CIA see it?
Well, early on, I think some people might have envisioned a role for them in Iran. But frankly, the nationalists and the National Front were so ineffective that it was almost pitiful. Not that after, in effect, abdicating the possibility of power to the Shah, then they simply thrashed around with unformed ideas, platforms that were so general they could have applied to anywhere, practically anywhere in the world. I think to some people, they were a disappointment because they were so ineffective. I think, as I said earlier, my feeling is that the nationalists missed several chances of establishing a respectable position because of such an adamant opposition to the Shah, particularly in the earliest days when the Shah was relatively speaking was weak. By the time the 60s arrived, and particularly by 62, the Shah had pretty well established his supremacy, and the nationalists no longer were in a position to do anything.
Then comes the Amini era.
Yeah, well, as I said, I think the Shah was somewhat reluctant to appoint Amini.
Was pressure brought to bear from Washington for his appointment?
I know that's a story. A lot of Iranians thought it was the case. It's possible that when the diplomatic stuff becomes publicly available, there may be something in there. But I don't know of anything. I was in Iran at this time.
What years were you exactly?
62 or 64. End of 64. That was my second tour. There was a... Okay. Amini had been ambassador in the United States. Mm-hmm. He had a good reputation with American officials, with State Department people, and a variety of others outside of the agency, and I, Whereas American officials and ambassador had spoken well of him, and even talked about him as a potential prime minister. I suspect, although I can't prove it one way or the other right now, I suspect that this general feeling among American officials about Amini's qualification to be prime minister may have been interpreted indeed by the Shah and other Iranians as a signal that the Americans wanted Amini.
It seems to many that America was looking for an alternative, because there's also allegations at this time that they were checking Bakhtiar's.
You say
they were looking at Taimur Bakhtiar seriously. And there was the whole story of when Bakhtiar went to Washington and met with Kennedy, and that led to his removal eventually. That there was this sense as if... did you have this feeling that America was looking for someone else?
No, I don't.
And if they were, then what was the reason?
No, I don't have that feeling. On Bakhtiar, he did a lot of talking to the station chief, a lot of griping about the Shah.
To the CIA station.
Yeah.
This is in late 50s.
No, this would have been, say, in the year before he probably left Iran.
At that time, station chief was Yatsevich, no?
Yeah.
Yatsevich.
I believe it still was, yeah. So we had a pretty good idea of what was bothering Bakhtiar, which was practically everything about what was going on.
But what was it exactly? Because right now it looks like the Shah's regime was moving on smoothly. What was the main problems, either which Washington was aware of or Bakhtiar was aware of?
Well, without recalling the material in detail, I think it was economic problems, which Iran was having at the time. The Shah's, things that the Shah was doing or was failing to do that Bakhtiar thought he could do better.
Mm-hmm.
It was this sort of thing. You know, over the years, there were dozens of reports of plotting against the Shah, sometimes military officers, sometimes combinations. So this sort of thing was kind of endemic. It never came to anything. Mostly people, I finally assessed them as people frustrated for one reason or another, getting together and doing some kind of low-level wishful thinking or wishful plotting. And I think Bakhtiar's griping was on a little higher level than that. Whether or not he was doing this and telling to the station chief for the purpose of winning American support for a move, I don't know. I never saw anything to indicate that was the case. I never saw anything to indicate that wasn't the case. When Bakhtiar was removed, I'm not aware that there was any great weeping and wailing about it, which would have been the case if the agency or if the United States had planned on him to be some kind of a strong man. I think there would have been a considerable amount of unhappiness in the agency. I detected. It was just the Shah showing his teeth again, if you like. And at the same time, you remember, he removed
Hidayat Qarani and Vasul, General Vasul.
There was a Alavi Mogadam.
Alavi Mogadam,
yes.
Why were they removed? There was always a charge that they had contributed, money was contributed to the Republicans, and then it was alleged that the money was out, brought out of U.S. military aid, and but you were...
No, I don't know anything about that. I think our assessment at the time was that the Shah just decided it was time to make a complete sweep of people on this level, getting rid of Bakhtiar. All of these people had been in their positions for some time. And I'm sure they were gathered supporters and a certain amount of
patronage and
power and influence.
But Bakhtiar's trip to Washington was the result of his complaints to Yatsevich? That as a result, was he invited to go there? And he
No, I'm not aware that that was... I'd have to look at the chronology again, and it's a little hazy. Supposedly he came over on business.
Right, and then he met with the president. And then the people who were accompanying him reported this to the Shah. And that's
well, I tell you, the only contact I had with that was with Ali Nabi Ali Khami.
Right, right. Who was one of the people who was on that trip?
He was on the trip. He was also a Department 7 analyst, political analyst.
Of Sabah.
Of Sabah. I don't believe you or not, but
yes.